criticizing in Lutheran spirituality was this tendency to think that you just make this act of faith, God saves you, and then there's nothing you have to do. And he says you just can't reconcile that with the apostles and with the folks in the Gospels, that somehow to accept Jesus Christ means that you do certain things. And he was worried that this Lutheran doctrine of emphasizing sort of like faith over works had just turned them into a group of people who were utterly conventional, right? Like it's our job is just to sort of like be good citizens or be conventional, that we're just sort of like everybody else and we're kind of nice and we don't think that this is a teaching that somehow energizes you to do certain things or demands or requires that you do certain things. Now, the reason I say that is because, you know, for years I've always worried that for a number of my sophomores who come in with this doctrine of moral relativism, that that good and right and wrong are just opinions and so on, there's a part of me that always worries that that's a kind of a doctrine of cheap grace. Because what is the cost in believing that there is no moral law, there is no natural law, there are no kind of, you know, standards on you as a human being to act a certain way? You know, the cost is zero. And the perk is that you sort of look liberal, enlightened, and non-judgmental. Right? I got my values, you got your values, I'm not judging you, you're not judging me, and so on. In fact, my wife and I have this running joke that when she's pointing out something in my character or something I've done that really needs being corrected, I just give her this pushback of, stop judging me! Right? I mean, isn't that like a great escape clause? You know, somebody who has sort of a real legitimate point to make about something you've done, and now you can always throw it back. No, you're judging me. No, you're the problem. And that's what I worry is that the moral relativism is a kind of a doctrine of cheap grace. And that I've shared with you before. I guess the new thing is this. I'm reading things from sophomores where they want to say things like, I don't think our, you know, that... you know, our society is like the best society. There's no culture that's better or worse than any other culture. You know, just because you remember this culture doesn't mean that your culture is better or another culture. In other words, they have this kind of doctrine of, you know, all cultures are equal no matter what. And to me, this is like, again, this is another doctrine of cheap grace. You don't have to live with the consequences of that belief because you live in a country that is wealthy and relatively free. You know, if you lived in a culture where there was like perpetual violence or grinding poverty or, the technological infrastructure just wasn't there, really? Would you still have this doctrine of somehow everybody's equal or all these cultures are equal? Or, you know, it's a view that, again, it costs them nothing. Okay? If you actually have to live in other cultures where there are all sorts of obstacles. I mean, I think of something like, this is the example that I give them. I said, you know, you live in these racially homogeneous, you know, neighborhoods where you don't actually have to deal with other cultures. When I was a graduate student, I lived in a house that, it was a four-story house, and the graduate students lived on the top two floors. And it really was an international house in the sense that we would get students from countries in Africa, countries in Asia. And I'll never forget housing with these graduate physics students from China, that their idea of cooking was everything was on the highest heat in oil, and cleaning the kitchen was women's work. So you never did that. And there were no women living there. Okay? So that is a cultural, you know what I mean? That's a cultural gap. That I point out to students, that's the thing that creates real friction. Because the Americanos don't have this idea that somehow you can just cake the stove with grease and let that be. Okay? And it's only when you have those kinds of things happen that you realize these kind of differences in culture and the impact that they make. Because you have to live with it. Okay? That's something that, by and large, our students never have to do. They never have to do. They never have to deal with another culture. In fact, I have had the experience of asking them things like, do different cultures have different moralities? Boom, yes, yes. Okay? Give me examples. I can have a room full of 16-year-olds who dogmatically believe that all these other cultures have completely different moralities who can't give me a single example. They can't give me a single example. So along with this sort of non-judgmental attitude they have, really what it amounts to is they don't have to know anything about other cultures. They don't have to know anything about Israel or Japan or Kenya or Germany. They don't have to know anything about anything. So they think they've got this point of view of, hey, everything's equal. We're all equal. I'm no better than you. You're no better than me. And what that translates to is, I don't have to know anything about you. There's nothing that you have that I'm going to learn from. There's nothing I have that you're going to learn from. I don't have to know anything. Okay? So they think they have this doctrine of, they think they've got something that makes them humble, right? I'm no better than anybody else. And, you know, it will come up in little ways. It will come up where I'm pointing out something about geography or pointing out something about another culture. And there's this sort of like, do I have to know this? Like, do I really have to know that, you know, that country's over there or that country is there or they're ruled in this way? Or, and I point out to them, at the point where you talk to people outside the United States, and you know nothing about their language, their history, their culture, the inference they draw from that is that you are arrogant. Because nothing outside your own country matters. You think you're being humble. You tell yourself, I'm no better than anyone else. Really? At the point where you really think other people matter, they really could be have something to offer, then you learn about it. But at the point where you talk to someone from, let's say, Russia, and you don't care the difference between Russia, Belarus, the Ukraine, you don't care about their history, you don't care what kind of different language they have, what that tells them is, I am an arrogant American. And the only thing that matters is my own country, and really, at the end of the day, you don't matter. So, you know, when we hear this language of kind of like tolerance and openness and so on, I mean, it could be people are really genuinely trying to be nice and get along, but I worry that what's behind that could be really a rationalization for not having to trouble yourself about what it is that other people believe, how they live, what their language is, where they're from. You can just be completely indifferent to anything, even outside your own neighborhood, let alone outside your own state or your own country. And that's a hard temptation to fight, especially for our young people. Because I just think the culture, I mean, you and I mean, the whole reason that you have them in a school like this is because you want them to be aware and you want them to know and so on. You want them to understand the world around them. But it's like there's this pressure from the culture that you don't have to know anything. You know, you don't have to know anything. You don't have to understand anything. You can watch some cool National Geographic documentaries, and maybe that'll do it for you. Maybe that'll solve the problem. But you just don't have to, like, study these people. I mean, by converse, think about the British when they had an empire. I mean, you want to talk about really snobby people. And yet, the British really cared about understanding India or Kenya or Nigeria. And they could tell you the customs. And they could tell you the population. They could tell you the laws. They could, you know. I mean, the British didn't even pretend to be humble. But they would trouble themselves to understand what these other cultures were like. You know, you can sort of see it in the Encyclopedia Britannica. There's this precision about getting these other cultures right. Anyway, that's my little homily about that.
What's the solution?
Well, the first solution is to point it out. The first solution is to point it out. I mean, that's the first thing I point out to students is when I get this, you know, why do I have to care about this? Is to push back with, this is why people outside the United States think you're arrogant. People in Korea have to study American history. If you give high school Korean students, you know, tests in, let's say, the Civil War, chances are they'll do just as well or better than our students do. Because they're taught that this is important to understand. This is a powerful country. You got to understand where these folks are coming from. So the first thing is to point it out. But then the second thing is, as you know with all lessons to teenagers, that you have to keep pointing it out over and over again. But then finally that... you know, to the extent you can, to help them have this have the kind of experiences which would allow for that realization. You know, in other words, you know, that you encourage, you know, your college kids to have a junior year abroad. That when you visit I always hear during spring break, people in this community going to different countries, you don't want your child saying something like this. When I ask, have you seen real poverty before? I mean, not one car, one TV poverty, but, you know, real poverty, you know, shanty town poverty. And one girl raised her hand, oh yes, when we visited Jamaica, we got off in the, you know, at the wharf, and we got onto the tour bus, and as we're going up to the resort, you can see these shanties on either side of the road. Okay, probably not, that's not the ideal in terms of what you want a child sharing for an experience of poverty. I saw it from the tour bus. You know, you want them to encounter this thing directly. That's why I with our seniors, you know, I don't teach seniors. I mean, can one teach seniors? But I have juniors this year. I don't have seniors this year. When I do have seniors, I try to encourage them. I know there's this great pressure on you to go to college right away. You know, there's this pressure. Somehow if you don't get out of college by your 22, I mean, like, you've missed a crucial year that, like, everybody else has gotten internships and fellowships and jobs, and you're going to be homeless under a bridge. But, I mean, if you can spare you a year or two, do mission work. Do mission work in the United States, you know. Do mission work outside the United States, you know. Go to an underdeveloped country. I would have been a lot better off going off to college if I had had some life experience, not just life experience of the suburban kind of neighborhood I grew up in, but life experience of a very different culture, very different, you know, way of life. I didn't do this, but I had friends who, when I was in Anchorage, when I was in Alaska, that they worked with Mother Teresa's organization for a year before they went to college. You know, those kinds of things. In other words, to encourage those kinds of things. You know, the kind of trips we at Providence, we have these trips. I hear great things about the kids who went to Ecuador and who went to the Galapagos. You know, they really experience things that, you know, just basic things like how the plumbing works. You know, you can't just dump toilet paper down the plumbing. You can't handle that. You know, you'd be surprised what a revelation that can be. Go ahead, man.
But I think when you were talking about Bonhoeffer, Bonhoeffer has a great story that he writes about during that time of a Lutheran church that was on the train tracks. And they would hear the trains full of Jewish people going by crying out during the services. And their motto was, sing louder. Yeah. And I like sharing those stories with my kids.
Yes.
Because here's this moral dilemma. You have these Christians and their fear of the government or standing up against what all of society around them was doing was, we'll just sing God's words louder.
Louder, yep.
Well, we know these people are off to be killed and
right.
treated horribly.
Yeah.
And I kind of think in our society, we aren't sharing those stories of real moral dilemma as Christians or as Catholics with our kids. How do you stand up and say, this is what I believe and that's okay, but I think if we don't, they will water it down by what you were talking about before of saying yours is fine and mine is fine.
Sure.
And get swayed on what is a clear line of moral and value.
So let me say two things to that. One, Anne-Marie Funk, our new religion teacher, was just sharing with me a book that she had called Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed. And it's about this village in rural France where they saved hundreds and hundreds of Jews. It was a predominantly Protestant village. There were some Catholics there. There were some other folks there who weren't even religious. But predominantly, this was a Huguenot Protestant village, which up in the highlands, during the occupation of France, you know, saved hundreds of Jews. So it's kind of the convert, and they did it from their Protestant Christianity. They did it as from the principles of their belief. The second thing I would say is, persecution of the Jews worldwide. There are 100,000 to 150,000 Christians that die every year because of their faith. The persecutions of Christians are as active now as they ever were. And this was something I was just going over with sophomores yesterday because we have this little unit on religious liberty. I said, I'm going to give you these numbers, I can give you these stories, but the problem is they won't seem real to you. Why? Not just because you don't live with persecution yourself. When you watch news, it doesn't matter what you watch. You know, kind of the conservative end with something like Fox News, or the liberal end with like Minnesota Public Radio or NPR or MSNBC. It doesn't matter. The persecution of religious people and the persecution of Christians is not an interesting story to journalists. So it's never covered. Never. And I said, you have to, your idea of bias is, okay, there's a story about Trump, Fox approaches it, kind of defending Trump, or MSNBC or CNN, they approach it thrashing Trump soundly, right? There's one story, but you're coming at different angles. The way to really see bias is not one story reported in two different ways, but it's what counts as a story at all. You know, what is it that's interesting as a story? You know, what is it that ends up there? Anyway, but I don't know that there are no easy solutions to things. Giving examples is helpful, but there really is no substitute for experience. I mean, in a way, you know, our young people need certain experiences, and it can be very difficult to provide them. I'm not saying this is easy, but books to some degree can provide a kind of vicarious experience, and so that's why we read. One of the things we have them read is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which takes place in Auschwitz. I mean, there's a reason we have them read that. But and that book has an impact. It does. You know, we've done it for 2 years, and students, you know, they it makes an impact. But there's only so far you can get with a book. There are certain things kids just need to see.
What's the title of that book?
With the one I just mentioned?
Yes.
Man's Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist in Vienna who was a Jew. So he ended up in Auschwitz. And he writes about Auschwitz from the point of view of a psychiatrist. And the thing that he comes to in Auschwitz is the people who have the best odds of surviving are the people who have a meaning and purpose in life. That's kind of the realization that he comes to. So when he survives Auschwitz and goes back to practice, it changes his whole outlook on psychiatry. Because he realizes that a lot of times what he has to do with somebody is not, you know, tell me about your mother, right? It isn't walking back through their childhood. It's like, what do you think your life's about? What do you think your goal and purpose in life is? And he says easily a third of his patients, they aren't really, you know, psychotic or neurotic or, you know, mentally diseased. There isn't really anything there. It's that they have what he calls existential neurosis. In other words, they're lost. They don't know what their life is about. They don't know what this is, why they do what they do, and so they're unhappy. And a big part of his role then as a psychiatrist is helping them realize what their purpose in life is. It could be a family purpose. It could be a professional purpose. I think Frankl ultimately wants to have some kind of spiritual or religious purpose, but there has to be something that really provides meaning and stability. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, Bethel Synagogue, there was a lady that would get up and sing different hymns or whatever, and she was a survivor of the Holocaust, and due to everything that had happened to her at Auschwitz, her ankles and her wrists were like this size.
Yeah.
They were just little, tiny, because she could never really gain weight.
Yeah, great, get it back. Yep.
So it was living and walking in front of me, and you could see the numbers on her. So it was like,
yep.
Wow.
Yep. That's, again, where you can provide those experiences for people, you try.
The Sunflower is another one.
Yes.
From the vet. Is that written by him as well?
No.
It's written by somebody else, but it's...
Yeah, same thing, similar thing. So, to Samson. Judges 13 and 14 is what I'll talk about today, and then more next time. Significance of Samson. Notice I have there's a kind of moral significance or a spiritual significance in the sense of a kind of a spiritual lesson, a personal lesson. Newman will take this line. You know, the gifts in Samson versus the fulfillment. When you look at 13, you know, Judges 13, there's this beautiful, if you like, annunciation story. You know, this is a child that's somehow singled out for gifts. And he's according to Numbers 6, he's going to be a Nazarite. Remember, the whole idea of Nazarite is that you are separated out. That's what it means to be a Nazarite. And it goes, again, to the Jewish notion of the holy and to the sacred. The first thing that those words mean is separated out. Okay, so that, like the way that if you have a chalice, and now you consecrate it for use at the Mass, Okay? You can't just like bring the chalice back and put Kool-Aid in it. Right? It's been separated out. It no longer belongs to ordinary use. So that that you take a member of the chosen people, and it's not just like that he belongs to, let's say, a special tribe, but now this is an even narrower division. Right? Obviously, the tribe of Levi was separated out for service to the Lord. But now Nazirite, I mean, this is even more like a more kind of elite cut. Right? There's this, it's almost the closest thing I think that you're going to see in the Old Testament to something like religious life, like monastic life, like in other words, a life of perfection. Okay? So Samson receives, in terms of gifts from the Lord and from his parents and so on, you know, everything that he needs to be a holy person. And then, you know, beginning of chapter 14, he's already chasing the pagan girls. Okay? And Newman will take that as that narrative as almost a kind of expression about the disparity that you sometimes see between the sacraments and, you know, the life of a Christian. Right? The baptism prepares you for a life of holiness. Right? Confirmation perfects that. And it's true that the Eucharist nourishes it, but you know, with you've got your baptism, your confirmation, your first Holy Communion, you are good to go in terms of now living a holy life. Okay, well, where is the preparation? What does the preparation allow for? And then where are most of us at? Okay, so the disparity that you see in Samson is in some way a lesson for all of us, right? We may not be like, again, chasing the pagan girls. But what is it that the graces of God prepare you for versus how do you actually live your life? Right? How big is that gap? I mean, for all of us, there is a gap. How big is the gap? What are we doing to narrow the gap? So we can't simply look at Samson and say, what a rascal. You know, God tries to do these things for him, but you know, God does things for all of us. All of us have these graces and the calling, and yet we don't seem to fulfill it. Lillian Klein, who has this book on the use of the triumph of irony in the book of Judges, she says that in a way Samson is a kind of image of Israel itself. You know, that Israel itself, this people itself, they've been brought out of out of slavery. They've been brought into the promised land. They've been endowed. They've been assisted by angels. They've been given revelation. There are all these things that they've been given. And yet, there's just, again, this kind of gap between how they're living as a people and what God has prepared for them. So again, think about the wonderful scene that we had earlier in Judges where when they come back to Gilgal and they're being rebuked for not keeping the covenant, for not conquering the land, and they just all start crying. And but the message of Scripture is, you know, your tears aren't enough. I mean, you act sorry, but nothing ever changes. You know, you're there's this rebuke, but then there isn't repentance leading to, you know, reconversion. So there's a way in which Samson here is the most memorable character in the book of Judges. Is in some way an image of Israel itself in this way. Then finally, there are several points where church fathers like Augustine and Ambrose will talk about how Samson is in a way a figure of Christ. So with that, he's chasing pagan girls, okay, on the literal level, problems. Okay? On the figurative level, this is, remember, in some way, this is a foreshadowing of the call of the Gentiles. That Christ, truly God, truly man, calls all people to himself. And remember, coming out of the Old Covenant, the most remarkable thing about that he would call the Gentiles, that the nations will convert, that those who have not been formed in the covenant are somehow going to be invited into it. Okay? So that's the point that I've been making for the last couple of classes, is that you have to understand that there are things that can be actions on the literal level that are bad actions, that on the mystical level can signify something good. So Samson's attraction to this pagan girl, someone like Ambrose can look at that and say, "And here is Jesus calling the nations, bringing in those who are unbelievers." Please remember that a lot of the parables work that way. On the literal level, right, you have unjust stewards who are embezzling. You have unjust judges, right? You've got all sorts of bad behavior somehow on the literal level that somehow is meant to signify something good on the spiritual level. You know, that's the thing you have to understand about the way the Bible teaches. The Bible is not saccharine or smarmy. It really is an edgy book. And so it will use things that on some level are bad to make a fairly lofty and spiritual point. Okay, words. There are some things that are just hard to bring out of the language. I'm going to hit a couple of them. At the beginning of the narrative in 13, a lot of translations will talk about Manoah and his wife. The word, however, that's used is woman. And in fact, there are a lot of languages where there isn't, strictly speaking, a word for wife. There's a man's woman. You know, just like, we upper-class suburban people don't talk this way, but, among the lower orders and less educated folks, think about Porgy and Bess, right? Bess, you is my woman now.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's my man. Okay? There aren't these separate terms for husband and wife. There are men and women, and there's my man or my woman. Okay? So the reason that's important is because the term, that word woman, is used throughout the Samson narrative. And the fact that in the first sentence, the Israelites once more did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He gave unto them the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. And then the next line, there was a man from Zorah, the clan of the Danite. His name was Manoah, and his woman was barren. Now, a lot of times you're going to read that his wife was barren, but woman is significant because then that word is used over and over and over again. And again, has this effect of women are important in this section of the story. Okay. Again, you're told that he received the Spirit. We still have our notes over here. Remember, Samson has the Spirit mentioned more in his section than the other judges combined. But if you recall with Gideon, you remember the Spirit clothed him. Okay. Spirits, in some sense, come in other narrative, for other judges, they'll come upon people. For Gideon, he's clothed with it. For Samson, the verb that tends to be used is a word that means rushed, like hurrying upon something. So yeah, you can put it descend, but descend almost like the way you think of the Holy Spirit, like right, like that. So, in other words, it's a verb that expresses like vim and power. And when you look at the effect of the Spirit with Samson, remember, don't think of the Spirit like a spirit of understanding, a spirit of knowledge, a spirit of the, don't think like that. This is more like when Popeye rips open the can and eats his spinach. I mean, it's almost more like that. That would be a kind of more accurate picture that you should have. Okay. Samson, the name itself, comes from a word which is related to the sun. Okay, it's related to the sun. And Delilah, her name is essentially in the language means night. So, the story of Samson and Delilah is a story of day and night. Okay. And again, it's easier when you're working in a language that you're being named directly for things. Think about the wonderful point you were making, Karen, about, Avi Melech, right? The son of the king. People have these names that are significant. A lot of times when we name children, we just don't name them that way. oh, I've always liked the name Carol, right? I've always liked, you know, Emma. I've always liked Emma. You know, there, you like the sound of it, and if it has some kind of significance, that's like a, that's like an extra. That's like a bonus. But if we aren't naming a child in honor of somebody, you know, my son isn't so much named after me. He's actually named after my father. There's this long line of Arthurs, And then their middle, like my girls, they all have the middle name Marie, and that's after my grandmother and my aunt. Again, lots of Maries. I mean, if you aren't doing something like that, generally there is a, you just kind of like the sound of the name. You know, it just sounds good to you. Whereas naming that happens in these cultures always expresses a kind of an idea or an expectation. It would be like you named your boy Hunter and you already bought him a rifle. You know what I mean? It would be like that, that I'm giving him this name because he's going to go out and shoot a, you know, a 6-point buck, right? You already have this idea of this is what he's going to do, okay? When Samson sees this this young woman from this Philistine village of Timnah, some translations will say, you know, she pleases me. The literal phrase is, she looks right in my eyes. She is right in my eyes. And that eyes part is nice because it shows you kind of where his judgment is. You know, that she looks hot, basically. she's a 10. Okay? And that's enough for him. Okay? In some way his judgment is sort of foreshadowed by his own father. You know, think about what you get from Manoah. The angel appears first to his wife. We never get a name for his wife. This is Manoah's woman. We don't get a name. And she kind of readily seems to understand what this is about. And when she reports it to him, he is not kind of quick on the uptake. Really? Could I hear this guy? Could you say that again? He has to be sort of walked through it. And one of my favorite parts of this narrative. Remember that he asks for a sacrifice, to offer a sacrifice. There's a flame that goes up. Robert Alter, by the way, makes the point that that's a kind of a foreshadowing of how fire is going to occur in the narrative. Remember that that's how he gets back at the Philistines. He gets all these foxes and puts a torch on their tails and runs them through the field. Yeah, that's how he gets back. So that there's this, you know, fire that he offers, you know, is a sort of signal of kind of how this works. But she explains to him, Manoah, that it, or the wife explains to Manoah what this stranger is and what he wants, and she seems to understand the miraculous character of this quicker than he does. He needs to kind of confirm this. Behold, the man who, verse 10, she ran in haste. The man who came to me the other day has appeared to me. Manoah rose, went after his wife, came the man. Are you the man who spoke to this woman? I am. Manoah, now, when your words come true, what's the boy's manner of life? What is he to do? And, right, the angel makes clear he's going to be a Nazarite. He's going to be set apart. Manoah said to the angel, please, let us detain you. Prepare a kid for you. And the angel Lord said to Manoah, if you detain me, I will not eat of your food, but if you make ready a burnt offering and offer it to the Lord. For Manoah did not know he was an angel of the Lord. So the wife seems to have a quicker idea that there's something supernatural about this guy than the husband does. In other words, the husband almost kind of foreshadows Samson's spiritual obtuseness. The mom is evidently on a kind of a spiritual wavelength that the father is not. What is your name that we may honor you? Why do you ask me my name, seeing that it's wonderful? Manoah took the kid with the cereal offering, offered in the rock to him who works wonders. The flame went up. The angel ascended in the flame while Manoah and his wife looked on, and they fell on their faces to the ground. And it's afterwards, it's after all this, that it really dawns on Manoah, hey, there's something really supernatural about this. And on the one hand, again, we could think that there's something about this guy that driveway doesn't quite reach the street. But But this is fairly often in Scripture, that you can have people that they don't realize there was something supernatural there until later. So, you know, think of Joseph, or Jacob, that Jacob has the dream, the angels ascending and descending on the ladder, and he wakes up, and he has to sort of reflect a while, and he realizes, you know, God was here and I knew it not. How fearful is this place? You know, it's like the realization comes later. So Manoah, when this realization comes, he says, "We shall surely die, for we have seen God." Right? He's awed by this. In that sense, he's a little above his son. You know, Samson doesn't appear ever to be awed by anything. You know, this man is at least capable of awe. Now, here's the line I just love. And for some reason, I just picture like just some working class, lady from Brooklyn, you know, saying it this way. Because my childhood experience of this woman I knew, I can just picture her saying this. If the Lord had meant to kill us, he wouldn't have accepted a burnt offering and cereal at our hands, right? You can almost see her hitting him on the back of the head, right? We're going to die! You idiot, if we were going to die, you would have killed us 20 minutes ago, okay? You can just see this. The woman bore a son, called his name Samson. Again, this is why does she pick this name son? You know, like this word related to the son? We don't know. Is it continuing our motif of the fire here? We're not sure. The boy grew, the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir in him. Okay? And the commentator goes out of the way to say, you know, after Samson, at the beginning of 14, hey, get me her. She's right in my eyes. Right? She's smoking, basically. His father and mother did not know it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. This is the remarkable thing, that God is going to take this man's tendencies and still work his will. That's the point that I have over here. Samson's purpose versus God's plan. You know, Samson's purpose always seems first and foremost to get what he wants. And what he wants is usually something, you know, very material, very accessible, and to the extent there's thinking involved, that's not his, you know, that's not his high, strong point. But he's quick to either, you know, his two motivations are basically sort of a kind of physical satisfaction, and then of course his honor, right? You would not have guessed my riddle if you hadn't plowed my heifer, right? You've been fooling with my woman, in other words, right? Now his honor's offended. Okay? But that is that's the amazing thing about God's power. He isn't going to look at someone like Samson and say, oh, rats, I guess I'm going to have to get someone from the next generation or get someone from someplace else. No, he can still work with this guy's grave flaws and accomplish the will that he's going to accomplish. He doesn't need perfect instruments. There was a fellow, in fact, I don't know if I mentioned this, that years ago when I was at Thomas Aquinas College, he gave a lecture specifically on Samson, in this section of the book of Judges. And the lecture was entitled The Jawbone of an Ass. Because the feat that he does later on, beating up these Philistines with the jawbone of an ass, in a way that is symbolic of Samson himself. You know, just as Samson is taking this jawbone of an ass and beating up all these Philistines with it, it's like the Lord himself, in using Samson, is using something that's essentially the jawbone of an ass. This is somebody who's big, strong, and powerful, and will accomplish his will with all sorts of bumps along the way. And certainly not because Samson is trying to understand that will or work with that will. No, go ahead.
Does that explain then why Samson goes by by the Lions carcass. Now he's a Nazarite. He's not supposed to have.
He's not supposed to be handling the dead. He's certainly not supposed to be getting honey out of dead things. Comes home and offers it to his parents. Doesn't even tell them where it's from.
Right.
And I mean, Nazarite or not Nazarite, wouldn't you think that if a kid brought home some honey from you, like it's from a carcass, would be important information? But yeah, yes, yuck.
Yeah, we were just hung up on that because of the fact that, you know, he's a Nazarite. You know, it's been said, you know, by the angel of the Lord that he's not supposed to have anything unclean. The mother's not supposed to have anything unclean, and then he goes and eats all this honey out of a dead carcass. And
That's what I mean by this gap between what is expected of him, what the script is for him being a Nazarite. And the way that he acts, you know.
And yet God still uses him.
God, that's the thing. God's plan is not thwarted by his failings. If anything, I mean, the whole episode. Why is that episode with the carcass there? I mean, it's not significant in terms of the liberation project, right? The reason that that's there is to help you understand where this guy is at. That's why that thing is there. It would be as if, you know, you've got some story about a Catholic priest, and like the opening scene is that he's, you know, drunk as a skunk, trying to put on his vestments and having trouble putting on his vestments as he's going to go say Mass. You know, the gap between what you expect of this. Of the person given who he is. In fact, you'll get some commentaries that will question whether or not he's really a Nazarite. They'll say, well, you know, maybe his mom intended him to be, or maybe there was a different understanding of being a Nazarite at this time, or no, the whole narrative works because he really is one. Really. That's how the narrative works. There are these expectations of being a Nazarite, which he is not even close to fulfilling. You know, so again, like if you think about Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory, right? This is a whiskey priest. Okay? But the way that, if you're familiar with Graham Greene's book, Graham Greene's book is about this priest in Mexico during the period of persecution of the church. During the period of what we call the Cristeros and the, you know, the Masonic governments. And this is a priest who's an alcoholic. But what the book is about is how this priest gradually is able to do something that is heroic. And you look at him in the beginning of the book, you know, this guy is, you know, not capable of that. You know, there's this beautiful trilogy of books that Graham Greene wrote, The End of the Affair, The Power of the Glory, and is it The Human Factor? This is where Graham Greene was a convert. Later on in life, he ended up drifting away from his conversion. But early on, he wrote these lovely Catholic novels. And all of those novels involve people who are very flawed, but yet are able to do these heroic things that their beginnings wouldn't promise. So The End of the Affair is about this woman who hasn't grown up religious at all, but she's married to a very dull civil servant, and she's carrying on this torrid affair with this writer, and this is during the 1940s, during the Blitz, and there's a point where they're at, I think, his apartment, and they've just, you know, spent the whole afternoon canoodling, and a bomb goes off, you know, one of the shells drops. And she comes out, and he's like in the entryway, and he's flat, and he looks dead. And she just has this impulse. She prays, God, you know, let him live. If you let him live, I will dedicate myself to you. You know, if you let him live, you know, I'll turn to you, and he lives. And so she keeps her word. She ends the affair, and she starts going to church, and she starts, you know, and goes through the process of coming into the Catholic Church. And he doesn't understand any of this. He doesn't, you know, she didn't tell him, she just did it. Well, because she couldn't. She couldn't explain to him that was what was going on. How does he find out? He bribes her maid to steal her diary. The guy is just a rascal. He's just a complete rascal. But I've probably given you enough. It really is a wonderful book. It's not an easy book to read in some ways.
Which one is that?
the end of the affair. The end of the affair. Because this guy, what happens is the lover, you see this former mistress, that her heart is becoming more and more open to God, you know, as the book goes on. And because he resents this affair being ended, that he becomes more and more closed to God as the book goes on. So it's, yeah, there are movie versions of it. I think they're probably awful. So I don't do it. You know, well, what? A modern movie that's about an extramarital affair? I mean, what's that? What do you think you're going to see in that? You know, the Catholic elements tend to get downplayed somewhat. But the end of the affair, the book is wonderful. But again, the reason I thought of that, because I was thinking Power of the Glory, another Graham Greene book where you have this very flawed character. I think you're told, you're given this episode about eating the carcass from the honey, not just because there's this riddle that then that also causes problems with the Philistines, but just helping you understand that this is not someone who's living out this vow. This is somebody who simply does not take what he's been given seriously. But that does not frustrate God's purpose. And I think if you didn't have the narrator helping you out here, you would just think this is a lost cause. But the narrator understands that even these flaws in Samson's character still serve God's purpose. You know, God is not frustrated by our inadequacies. You know, he may be disappointed in our inadequacies, but he's not frustrated by them. He can still work even through our flaws, which, believe me, should be a great consolation for the betterment of the world. He doesn't depend on us, you know, all being exemplars of virtue. Okay, so we've talked about 13 and a chunk of 14. 14, 15, and 16 is what I'll focus on next time. And then that'll bring us to these ending chapters of the book of Judges, which are some of the darkest, you know, parts of the narrative, and in general, some of the darkest parts of Scripture. Oh yeah, the ending of Judges is so bleak. Oh yeah, it is. Very good. Thank you.